You were, well, a sergeant at that time.
I was a sergeant then, yes.
Can you, were you living in mess, or where were you billeted?
Well, it was, if you're talking about 1940...
July to October, yeah.
Well, in July we were at Gravesend, which was a civilian airfield which had been taken over by the Air Force. So we moved in there. There was no proper accommodation. We were living in a requisitioned house just off the airfield.
What were you doing before you went into the Air Force, and when did you go in?
Well, I was... before the war, I'd taken an instructor's course with the Volunteer Reserve, and... I'd obtained a job as a flying instructor with the Yorkshire Aeroplane Club at Yeadon. And then when the war started, we were all flying east of a line which included us was cancelled. We weren't allowed to fly at all. And two or three days before the war started, we were all mobilised. I was being a sergeant on the Volunteer Reserve.
So flying was going to be your life if there'd been no war?
Oh, yes, it already was. I was a flying instructor, yeah. And by the time the war started, I got 1,000 hours in.
Mm. What sort of background was your family?
My father was in farming, and I had no wish to take up farming, and he'd no wish for me to join the Air Force. So I became chemist apprenticed. And did 3 years of that. By that time, my father was had died, and my mother sort of said, "Rightio, if you wish to join the Volunteer Reserve, you may do so," which I did, and carried on flying from there.
Right. So we've got you to Gravesend near Gravesend in 40. You weren't on the station, so. First thing in the morning, what was the routine? How did you get woken, and what was the first thing that went through your head in the morning?
Well, approximately an hour before dawn, we would get a call by a corporal from the guardroom, who you put the call in for the previous evening, and you got a call. You'd have a cup of tea, you'd have breakfast. You'd get out to your aircraft. At Gravesend, we walked up from the house to the airfield, which was not very far, a couple of hundred yards. Walked up, did a check, had checks of the aircraft, got our parachutes out, put them on the tailplane, fitted our helmets in the aircraft, hung them over the reflector sight or over the control column, and then made ourselves as comfortable as possible, waiting for the first call. We were on, readiness, if we were on readiness, that is, about half an hour before dawn, before anything was likely to happen. So it was pretty early, and as we stayed on readiness till about half an hour after sunset, it was pretty late when we finished in summer. Mm. But of course, the one squadron didn't do the whole day. It would be on, say, readiness in the morning up till lunchtime. Then another squadron would take over and take over the readiness as from then, and we would go on to available, which meant that you had to be able to get in the air in 20 minutes or something like that. Can't remember the actual time. You couldn't go away if you were unavailable.
Is it too much to ask you to recall what it felt like the first thing you were called in the morning? I mean, did you wake up in a state of any tension, or did you wake up thinking, Christ, what's the weather going to be like, or what can you remember?
I remember that if it was pouring with rain, there was a big sigh of relief and everyone went back to sleep again. Sometimes, of course, you still had to get up and be there in case the rain cleared. But there was never quite the tension on a bad day that there was on a good day. If the sun was shining brightly and not a cloud in the sky, well, then you knew that you were going to have a lot of work to do that day.
Dispersal. Now, by then, sergeants, or this time, sergeants, pilots were mixing with officers, and you were all in the same dispersal.
Oh, yes, we were all in the same dispersal.
And passing the time somehow.
Yes.
How?
Well, what you normally did was you went out to your aircraft, which was some distance away from where your hut was, or where your telephone was, and... you lay under the wing and try to get some extra sleep in. The the main thing that remains in my mind now about the Battle of Britain was I was always tired. If you came down from a trip and it was the usual hot, blazing summer day that 1940 seems to stick in my mind as being, you climbed out of your aircraft, and if the intelligence officer didn't come along to you to take a combat report, if you'd had a combat, if he didn't come along to take it, you didn't bother to go to find him. You just got into the wing of the aircraft and tried to get some more sleep in. And then probably you'd be scrambled from there and get off another trip, and you never would get a report of that trip.
Some of the time, though, if you couldn't sleep so well, you must have read or wrote home or...
Oh, yes, all those kind of things were going on at the same time. Reading was a very, very popular pastime. Writing home was not quite so popular because the people at home wanted to hear that you weren't even involved in the war, and you actually were. You were the really sharp end at that time. And that one thing you sort of didn't want to write and worry your people at home about.
Can you remember the sort of tenor of some of your mother's letters to you at that time?
No, I don't think so. I can't remember that at all. Letters from mothers were all sort of domestic things, how the dog was keeping and how my brother was doing at university and things like that. I can't really remember sort of any sort of thought of worry or in her letters at all.
You presumably look forward to getting them. Or was mail important at that time? Can you remember? People wait for it?
Well, it was important, but never ever assumed the importance that they, to us, that it seems to do to people making films about submarine warfare and ships at sea.
Yes, all right. Now, at some point in this morning, you would presumably get a scramble. Now, films have done it with telephone bells and with somebody hitting a great big bell. What was it like in your case? Can you take me through a scramble? Can you explain, from the point of view laying under the wing, what you heard and what you had to do for those next few moments before
well,
you got airborne?
If you were the squadron or the flight was at readiness, one pilot would be detailed to be on the operations telephone. That was merely so that it wasn't that we didn't trust an airman or a corporal, but it was better to have a pilot there in case some information, flying information, was given at the same time or slightly before the controller said scramble. Every time the ops phone rang, everybody ceased doing what they were doing, and one ear was listening out, and they would be the pilot who picked up the phone would either go wave one hand and make indicate that it was not a scramble, or if it was just getting the information, he'd have a hand up as much as say get ready to go, and he would either say scramble if he got no further information, if he had any further information as to 50 plus coming in from the south or the east or at such and such a height, he would pass that on, and then we'd all rush out to the aircraft. Everyone roaring start up at the same time. The airman who would be sitting in the cockpit, the fitter who was sitting in the cockpit, would start the engine. While he was starting the engine, would pull on the parachute, which was, on, as I say, had been laid out on the tailplane. All he did was just duck under the strap, put it on, started pushing the quick-release straps into the box on the centre of the chest. And by that time, he should have had the engine going. You leapt up onto the wing on the left-hand side where the step was. As you'd leapt up on the left-hand side, he leapt over the right-hand side and stood there waiting to strap you in. As soon as he got the four straps over, and then you were taxiing out following your leader. Unless, of course, you were the leader, and then you taxied out and everyone followed you.
Well, what was it like taxiing out? They're not easy planes to... Are we talking about Spitz, are we?
No, I'm talking about Hurricanes at that time. You could taxi in a hurricane as fast as you like. The undercarriage was as strong as a fourth bridge. There wasn't much taxiing out in so much as it would be a case of, if you're all lined up on one side of Gravesend Airfield, it was a grass airfield, and regardless of the direction of the wind, you just wound the throttle open and went in that direction, straight off from the dispersal point, and climbed away, forming up into squadron formation as you climbed away, and picking a direction given you by the controller over the RT. The radio wasn't very much good in those days. We had about an old-fashioned HF set, which you had to tune. And communications, as they existed then, wouldn't be put up with for 10 minutes a day, or 10 seconds.
I did read one account in which somebody said that they would actually listen to ordinary radio if they were on patrol at that time. You could actually tune.
Yes, you could tune, yes. But if you tuned to ordinary radio, you didn't get any information from your squadron commander or as to, you know, whether he'd seen any aircraft or not. Mm. I can hardly really believe that anyone deliberately tuned to ordinary radio. But I do know that when we first went to France, the frequency on which we had been controlled at Tangmere, without being changed at all in France, appeared to get nothing else except the overseas service of the BBC. Which is quite pleasant.
Yes, but mixed up presumably with other things.
Mixed up with your own transmissions, yeah.
Now, we've gone through the scramble and you've actually anticipated my question about RT. What about when you were flying? How did you think about the enemy? Which, of course, you were calling bandits, which seems to sort of distance them in some way. Were they people? Were they machines? What were they?
No, I don't think they were people. We called them bandits. That was merely a code word which we were given when we were given the other code words, such as scramble, meaning take off. Bandits meant either unidentified or enemy aircraft. Anything could be a bandit that was not definitely identified as friendly. We used the code word Angels for the height we were going to. Angels 15 was 15,000 feet. We had various ones like Buster for full throttle and Saunter for throttle back and cruise at economical cruise, and Gate, which was absolute emergency full throttle through the gate, as we called it. You see, there was a gate on to stop you going into absolute maximum boost. And a bandit was never intended sort of to describe the aircraft or the people in it or anything like that. I can't remember the one offhand now what the Germans used, but it wasn't quite as emotive as the word bandit.
Was there any sort of chivalry? I mean, people have used this word about this time. Do you remember any sort of chivalry? Was there a code in which the way people fought? Were you tempted? Did you know of anybody being shot down after they'd bailed out, or shot at after they'd been bailed out, and that sort of thing? Were there any rules?
I don't know what you mean by chivalry. I mean, if it meant to give a man an even break, the answer was there was no chivalry at all. I mean, I much preferred to kill someone without him even knowing I was there. And his first indication that he was being shot at was when bullets started coming out of his chest. You didn't give a chap an even break. You were there to get rid of his aeroplane, and incidentally him at the same time, but I tell you, that didn't really cross your mind that you were firing at a man. You were firing at an aeroplane of the wrong kind, wearing the wrong markings and flying in our sky, and we'd been told to get rid of them, and we got rid of them. There was no feeling about it Not in the least. I didn't have any feeling about it at all. I didn't go around hating Germans or liking Germans. I'd never met a German in my life. So I couldn't sort of have any preconceived opinion of what a German looked like or talked like or acted like. But I didn't hate them. I didn't like them. It was just that we were fighting them.
But what for?
Because we were told to fight them. We were told we were at war with Germany. I remember Chamberlain telling us we were at war with Germany, which didn't give me butterflies in the stomach. It gave me vultures in the stomach.
Yes, but if you said to people at 20 nowadays, we're at war with whoever you like, do you think there's going to be the same sort of feeling about it as you had at that time about being at war with Germany?
Well, you're asking, you know, someone now of who I think looked upon as square and deadbeat and not in touch with the modern generation any longer. But I do think there would be it would be different in so much as when we were young, we had parental authority. All of us listened to our parents. All of us did exactly what our parents wanted us to. There was none of the violence and assaulting of policemen that going on then that goes on now. There wasn't such a thing as a hobby demonstrator. And I think that these demonstrators do it for something to do. Rather than having any deep felt feelings about it. In fact, what they want to do is to argue against authority at any time. And if authority said you're at war with Germany, they would all then automatically say, no, we're not. We've got opinions of our own, and even though they're just the only opinions we have is that they're different to yours. And they're different to yours merely because you say something and we say the opposite, without any feelings on the matter whatsoever.
So for you, would it... would the reverse be true, that you went to war simply because you were told to, without any feelings as to the rights or wrongs of it in that way?
No, I think that a lot of people there had got feelings. I was in the reserve because I could see a war. I was in the volunteer reserve because I could see a war coming, and I wanted to be trained when it started, not have to be conscripted and fight in an untrained condition. Lots of the pilots in the squadron felt that way about it. They were in the reserve for the same reason that I was. I also was in the reserve because I wanted to fly, and it would have been the only way I could possibly learn to fly, going to the expense of then as now of learning to fly. And I think that we all felt that Great Britain was in the right. We also didn't want to be told what we were going to do by Germans, by Russians, by French, by anybody. I can't remember who it was who said, my country right or wrong. And I think that's the way we felt about it, my country right or wrong. We were still British, and we were fighting for Britain.
Would you have even put it into words, this thought about what you were fighting for when you say your country, or would it have been taken for granted that everybody knew what you were talking about?
I think if I sort of said my country, everyone knew what we were talking about straight away. Our way of life, our physical ownership of the land, we weren't going to have Germans or anybody else owning it. I think that would still apply today.
But it wasn't, just to press it just for the last few seconds, it wasn't a question of thinking, oh, if the Germans come here, we know what atrocities they will commit. It was just that you didn't want them here anyway, whatever they were going to do.
Yes, I was never really taken in by the propaganda that we pushed out about German atrocities. It was obvious the majority of it was propaganda. The same as the German propaganda which came back to us about how the British behaved, you couldn't recognise yourself in it.
Have you got any particular memories, by the way, of any particular dogfighter?
I don't know. The so-called dogfights, I mean the aerial combats I had, which I have described ad nauseam. They only amount to one or two, which are usually picked out for me by the person who's talking to me. They know that I shot down the Hind Club bomb Buckingham Palace. They know that, well, it has become known, of course, that in my first fight I shot down three aircraft, and three in the morning. And that gets talked about a lot. But if I pick up my logbook now and open it up at a particular date and I see what I've just made an annotation, 1109 destroyed or 1109 damaged, I cannot recall any way what that fight was like. It could be any one of a dozen.
How long were you up in the air and how long did the combat last?
I would say the average length of time that the flight took would be about 30 to 40 minutes. With the fight lasting literally seconds to a minute or a minute and a half. During that time, the squadron usually managed to get split up completely. There would be an attempt made by the person who was leading the squadron to get them all together again. He would sort of say, rejoin over Maidstone or Tunbridge Wells at 15,000 feet or whatever height he was at. And people would try to join up, or else you'd get a call from control saying, I've got no further trade for you, return to base. And then we would make no attempt to join up at all. We would each then navigate his own way back to Gravesend. Gravesend, on a decent day, was quite easy to find. You could see the river from miles away. And
what about cloud? Presumably, when you got split up, you very often got lost in cloud.
At that time, there wasn't all that amount of cloud. 1940 was a brilliant brilliant summer. You might be above a cloud layer, that meant you had to come down below it and find out where you were and set a course from there.
But very often your enemy was playing hide-and-seek if there was any cloud.
Could be, yes, especially if he was on trying to make his way back to France. Well, then he would get into, would make use of any cloud that he could possibly find.
And your object was to make use of the sun?
Yes, that was to make certain that no one ever got an even break. He couldn't see you coming from the sun. But chances of being able to manoeuvre yourself into the sun, taking into account the fact that you might be coming from a down sun position where your airfield was. If you were taking off, say, in the afternoon, the sun was to the south where he was coming from. It's the southeast he'd probably be coming from. You were coming from the north, so you were visible to him. To get into the sun, you had to go around behind him and probably make quite a long tail chase of it to stay in the sun. Mm. You used the sun if you could. It was preferable to use the sun because he couldn't search absolutely in the sun for where the trouble was coming from, and if you could make use of that, you did so. But if the chances were very, very, I won't say very, very rare, but you had to attack from whatever position you were in.
You survived, and a lot of people didn't. And you also, with one of the highest scores in the battle, must have had something that a lot of people didn't.
Yes.
What was it?
I had 1,000 hours flying experience before the war started. And that is one of the things. Also, to say, I was trained when the war started. I'd got lots of experience. I also had a lot of luck. I was shot down, all told, nine times in the 16 weeks of Battle of Britain lasted. And when you're having your aeroplane shot down round you, I mean, twice I got out of it with burning from end to end, and once with no tail on it. When someone's done that to your aeroplane, you've got to have had a lot of luck to have avoided the bullets which mangled your aeroplane that didn't mangle you.
Can you tell me whether it was your ability to manoeuvre, your ability to master tactics, whether you were just a very accurate shot, what sort of components of the skills do you think that helped get you through?
That's a question I'm not certain of. I've never tried to split it down. I was a good shot. I'd been shooting ever since I was big enough to hold a gun. I knew my deflection shooting, because I was doing most of my shooting with live targets which were moving. I didn't do any sort of rifle shooting at targets which were not moving. I was well up on the theory of ballistics. I was done enough flying so that I didn't have to think, what do I do to turn left, or I threw an aeroplane around as though it was part of me. But I've never tried to give it any weighting as to what was the most important thing for keeping me alive. I just know I stayed alive.
Can you tell me how you get out of an aeroplane when it's been shot down?
Very rapidly. There's all these things which we had in the book saying invert the aeroplane, undo your straps, undo your oxygen, undo your radio, and then slide the hood back and invert the aircraft falling out. You never have time to do that. You just one panic ripping off of the straps which are holding you into the aircraft, back with the hood and out as fast as you can. There was one time I just pulled the pin out of the straps and the aeroplane bunted over and I was thrown straight out. And at that time we had about 3/4 inch thick rubber oxygen tube, which, with no quick release pull-out mechanism, it was a burnet fitting which held you firmly attached to the aircraft. That broke, actually, as I went out. The radio, connection would pull out anyway. It was a quick release plug. But if you've got time to think about rolling the aircraft onto its back, well, then, in my opinion, probably it was not necessary to get out.
But is it like... I wonder if anybody's got any parallel experience. Is it like when you're having an accident in a car, everything seems to slow down? You seem to have...
All the time in the world, yes. I think that is... Your reaction do become very, very much quicker. Whether your thinking keeps up with your reactions is another matter. Your main reaction is to go and to stay alive, and if you've got to go, you go very, very fast. You can't come back and sort of say, I did exactly this and exactly that and exactly the other. You're keeping your life, and you react very, very fast under those conditions.
When that had happened to you a couple of times, what was it that you felt? Did you ever feel afraid when you were flying?
Oh, yes, I felt afraid every single time I saw an aeroplane which I thought had black crosses on it. And I say, when I thought had black crosses on it, you would see little dots in the distance and you'd wonder whether that was one of our own squadrons or whether that was a squadron of enemy. And you watched them and watched them until you could eventually distinguish what type of aircraft they were. And by that time, the fear had gone to a certain extent, because you knew you were getting down to do the job you were trained to do. You were still very scared. At least I was still very scared, and I honestly don't really believe anyone who says he wasn't.
Yes, but it didn't stop you.
No, it didn't stop me. I would have been more scared to pull out and let the others see me pull out than I would be to go on in.
Did you come down in the water?
No, I've never landed in the water. One once was in France before the Battle of Britain, and the other two times were over Kent.
What sort of reception did you get when you landed in Kent and places like that?
Well, I landed one aeroplane with its wheels up in the field, which had these anti-invasion poles that had been put in to stop gliders landing. Well, I saw us, you know, I singled out a nice little run through. These things landed without ever touching one of them, and the owner of the field was most indignant. He told me it was impossible to land in the field. I said, I agree with you, I've just done so. And so before they'd even managed to get the aeroplane away, he'd had people repositioning his poles so that no one would land down the line that I landed down. He would have been much happier if I'd hit one of his poles and killed myself than landed in the field without hitting one.
What were the sort of things that made you afraid? Was it afraid of having to bail out, afraid of fire, or what? Or just a whole down?
No, I was just afraid. I'd never sort of, once again, I didn't analyse what I was particularly afraid of. I was more afraid on the ground while waiting to take off. I'd be waiting for that, the thing that really frightened me was waiting for that tannoy either to say scramble or the telephone to go. If the tannoy came on and no one spoke, it could, even sometimes it was given over a tannoy rather than over the radio. If the tannoy came on and someone was going and not saying anything, I could be sick before he'd had time to talk. My stomach just revolted and threw everything out. It was, you know, not very nice to talk about, but it was that was so. Once I can get myself strapped into an aeroplane, that wasn't too bad. That's what I say, I didn't have butterflies in my stomach, I had vultures.
Did you have a talisman or a good luck charm or anything like that?
Nope.
You didn't go through any routines or...
Nope. Didn't have to touch wood or carry a Popeye or a rabbit's foot or anything like that. I didn't, you know, I've never been superstitious.
It's just that it's not you.
It just isn't me, no. I'm just not superstitious.
What, how did, I mean, some of those young guys around you were, as we said, not lasting very long. How did you feel about other people not coming back, either just missing or you knew killed?
Well, when we moved from Gravesend to Kenley, we were once again in a requisitioned house, and in one of the rooms there were four sergeants, myself and three others. And after a while I became very conscious of the fact that in some of the other beds there'd been three sergeants in them, in other ones there'd been two, and I was the only one who was in my own, one of the original ones in my own bed. I was wondering how long, it made me wonder occasionally how long it would be before there would be another occupant in my bed, because all the others had been occupied more than once. Some says as much as three times.
How did you cope with that sort of change? Did you mention it among yourselves, or did you deliberately go out of your way to joke about it? How did you cope with it?
As far as I can remember, it was just never spoken about at all. If anyone didn't come back, you could prove quite conclusively that he'd done something wrong. If he'd done the right thing, he wouldn't have got shot down. That, I feel, was a little bit of sort of self-defense, because you never did anything wrong. You always did the right thing. So if anyone got killed, you had to prove to yourself that he'd made an absolute stupid mistake, and if he'd done the right thing, he would have been alive. Because I think you had to prove to yourself that if you kept on doing the right thing, you were going to stay alive. So anyone who got shot down didn't get a lot of sympathy, because he'd made a fool of himself.
Whatever happened to his things, I think in some squadrons, some of the officers actually divided things up. I mean,
no,
what, an agreement.
What we would do is... all his personal things would be gone through, so that there was nothing embarrassing sent back to his parents. You know, the contraceptives disappeared. If he was married, all the letters from other women rather than his wife all disappeared. If he had an Irving jacket and he wasn't shot down wearing his Irving jacket, that became anybody's who got there first, because it would only have to be handed back into stores anyway, you see. So everyone was always shot down wearing an Irving jacket. or any other issue, that he had that you particularly want. If you wanted it, you took it, because otherwise you had to hand it back into stores.
What about the clothing? Was it comfortable to wear? What modifications did you make yourselves to make it reasonable?
Oh, there'd no thought whatsoever had been given to flying clothing before the last war. You were expected to fly in your uniform with a overall over the top of it. I don't know whether you realise it, but there never, ever was a Spitfire, a Hurricane, any cockpit heating. You went up to 30,000 feet and froze. There was no heating up there at all. They started then giving us these Irving jackets, which was fine. There was lambs all lined, beautiful and warm. The only thing was to put a parachute on and a May West, put a May West on first and then a parachute on. You had to put the collar up, and the collar was a great big high collar which came up as far as the top of your head. You couldn't put it down when you got your parachute on, wouldn't you, May West on, so you had to fly with blinkers. You couldn't turn your head because the collar didn't turn, and you were flying along, you couldn't look behind. The first thing I always used to do when I was issued with one of them was to cut the collar off and finish up in trouble for, you know, defacing Air Force property. The fact that I was saving my life got nothing to do with it. They designed a bad garment, and I used to make it so that it was wearable, but I used to get into trouble every time I did it.
So you were wearing ordinary light boots or shoes?
Shoes, mostly. You know, the sergeants didn't wear boots by that time for flying. You'd be wearing light shoes. Or you could wear the issue flying boot. In fact, most people did. You sort of saw pictures of them walking around with a map stuck in one pocket, in one boot, and probably a Colt 45 stuck into the other. Why we carried the Colt 45, I don't know, but we were issued with it. It was the best thing to do. Looked rather like a cowboy, too, yes.
What, on the goggles, the helmet, oxygen mask, did that work well?
Yes, the helmets and goggles and oxygen masks probably had more development during the battle than any other part of flying clothing. They got better and better and better all the way through.
Another small detail. What was the food like? Can you remember? What did you eat? Must have been hungry.
It must have been all right, because, you know, I don't even remember it. It must have been perfectly all right. It wasn't. I know this wasn't half as good as the food that they get in the services today, but you know, I didn't put on weight. I didn't lose any though.
And you ate in mess or at dispersal, depending on your state of readiness.
Well, as I said, Kenley, at Gravesend, we didn't have a mess. It wasn't an RAF station. The officers had formed a little mess in the control tower, but the sergeants who were living in this requisitioned house used to eat their meals in the airman's mess, which was really, really just an extension of the cookhouse.
Can you remember, was the airfield ever under attack?
No, it never got attacked.
No, so the things didn't get destroyed, you got meals regularly.
Yes.
All that sort of thing.
I don't think that. I haven't any information, but it didn't look as though the Germans knew we were using Gravesend. It never got attacked at all. Mm-hmm. And yet, you have great showers of German aircraft flying over the top on their way up to London, but they never dropped anything on the airfield.
What about the lighter side of life? Presumably, did you live a monastic existence for the height of the battle, or did you manage to get away?
Well, you went out nearly every evening down to the Leather Bottle or the White Hart in the town and drank there until you got thrown out. I won't say closing time, because closing time didn't seem to matter very much in those days. And you woke with an average hangover. there were no WAFs at Gravesend. We had the luxury of WAFs when he got back to Kenley. But the local population thought we were gods. And
they did?
Oh, yes. We were very, very lucky at Kenley, at Gravesend, in so much as we had this civilian factory on the airfield, and they always used to rush into the shelters just as we were taking off for a scramble, and they'd be coming out just as we were getting back. And I'd must admit, we used to pull their legs to a certain extent. I'd call across to a pal of mine, "What did you get today?" And he'd sort of say, "Oh, only four Messerschmitts." "And did you, what sort of luck did you have?" "Oh, not as good as that, only got three." Well, of course, the word would be round the pubs that we'd be shooting them down like flies, and we just couldn't buy beer or anything like that when we got down. I mean, we probably hadn't seen anything at all, but we gave them plenty to talk about.
And what about the girls? They thought of you as guys, did they?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. We didn't have any trouble.
Dances at all?
I've never been to dances. I never went to a dance during the whole of the war. Mainly because I don't like dancing.
Mm-hmm. Pictures?
I guess we used to go to the pictures occasionally in Gravesend. If we had a stand-down afternoon, we would go to the pictures, leave a message that we were there in case we had to be recalled, and we would inform the police that we were there, and they always used to give us an escort back to the airfield, going like the clappers.
Yes, because those pictures were on, even if you went to an evening show, and it was still light, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Double summertime, if I remember rightly.
Yes, double summertime.
So that meant it was staying light until...
midnight, almost.
Oh, God. You don't remember what the beer was like at that time?
It was South Country beer. It wasn't even any better there than it is now.
Are there any stories that you've got from that time about how people treated you? I mean, you just said you didn't have to buy beer, but did you ever, in those 4 months, get on leave or away from the station for any length of time and anything demonstrated to you how people were regarding you as an airman?
No, I can't remember. I did get 14 days. I got 10 days leave during the Battle of Britain. I can't remember the dates now, but I know I got 10 days, but I came back up to Yorkshire where I was living in Wetherby, spent it with my mother, and once again I had an enjoyable time, but it doesn't stick in my mind. I can't remember how I was treated coming back there. Your old friends were willing and nice to, glad to see you again. Ones that were left, I mean, the majority of them were in the forces anyway.
You were all trying to catch up on sleep. You were all living fairly closely together.
Yes.
How did that... There must have, and you were all under tension.
Yeah.
Even though you've got these long patches of waiting and then intense activity.
Yes.
How did that show? Did you begin to get on each other's nerves or what?
No. I can't remember any argument, any animosity, any ill feeling, anything at all, except a lot of chaps who had very rapidly become friends, getting on very, very well together. I can't remember any odd man out or anything like that. It's amazing, looking back, how smoothly everything went. I mean, we were living in what, I suppose, look back and now we're rather awful times, really. I mean, as a way of living, as a way of working. And in the squadron, I mean, the 501 that I was with, we had the highest casualties of any squadron during the Battle of Britain. For one reason, we were never pulled out for a rest. And I think we lost, or was it 17 people during that time, which was the highest casualties. But there was never, ever any animosity or ill will.
And what about the officer sergeant situation? Did that produce any... I won't say tensions, but I mean, did it produce any... you were going back to different messes, and yet you were working together during the day, as closely as any group of men can.
Yes.
And yet, there was no... Was there any social life together?
Oh, yes, I remember my flight commander. It's not at Gravesend so much as when we got to Kenley, when we used to get bombed. The airfield used to get bombed quite regularly. The moment with the thing, the flight commander would ring up the sergeant's mess and sort of say, who wants to come down to the Greyhound in Croydon? And we'd all pile into his car and whistle off down to the Greyhound in Croydon. We'd live more than as just air crew rather than officers and sergeants.
So
it was the start of it, though. It had never happened before.
The battle broke up all the
yes.
rank business, did it?
I mean, to begin with, when my first joint 501 squadron, there were two different dispersals. We had two requisitioned houses as the sergeants and the officers' dispersal point, and we'd just be told to scramble and we'd go, and we hadn't the slightest idea where we were going or what had happened or anything. We never even heard telephone. We were just told to get going. But that all disappeared by 1940. That was 1939. It was very difficult, of course, for an auxiliary squadron during the peacetime. They'd had nothing else but officers.
How do you regard that breaking down of the old sort of rigid barriers of ranks? I mean, do you think that the battle actually brought that about? Did it stay? And did it benefit the Air Force, do you think?
Oh, it stayed, yes, certainly it stayed. Although, of course, they do return now to back to their officers' message or sergeants' message. But air crew have their own air crew message whilst actually at work.
So that's a permanent change brought about?
Oh, it's a good thing, and I'm glad it became permanent.
Why do you think you won?
Why do you think the British won, why do we win the Battle of Britain?
Why did you win the Battle of Britain, do you think?
Well, I'm quite certain that so long as aeroplanes and pilots were available, we could never have lost it.
Why?
Because we were not trained to think of being beaten. It never crossed anyone's mind that we could be beaten. If it really got down to it and thought about it, it was all too obvious that we could, but it never even crossed our minds that we could be beaten.
So it's men, machines?
Yes.
Men, it sounds like.
I think the men had a lot to do with it. The machines, now all the people who are doing this analysis of the Battle of Britain proved to us we couldn't have won it because our machines were completely inferior. But they may be inferior in one way. They'd probably say top speed, but they can't be inferior in all ways. I mean, it must be better than the other aircraft in doing something, even if it's only flying slower. And if you can fly slower than he can, well, then it's up to you to make use of that one way in which you are better than he is. If you can fly slow, well, then you damn well fly slow, and if he's got to come down to your speed to fight you, well, then you'll beat him if you're better flying slower than he is. I mean, I read books now which says the Hurricane was not as manoeuvrable as the 109. Well, I know very well that it is, because I could manoeuvre it and did manoeuvre it better than the 109. 18 109s shot down with an inferior Hurricane's not too bad.
Point taken, yes. The other thing is that now, do you see any significance in that battle looking back? What's its significance for you? What did it do? We know what it did in the nation's life. What did it do for you, do you think, or to you?
As far as I'm concerned, it was the one battle during the whole of the last war that couldn't be lost. I mean, if we'd lost that battle, there wouldn't have been any others.
Do you reckon you knew that at the time? Did you really know that?
Oh, no, no, that's only hindsight, isn't it? We didn't know that at the time. We didn't know it was the one battle that was going to be completely critical. And if we'd lost that, there wouldn't have been any more, would there?
Did it change you, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, I've just got... It gave me more opportunities, of course. I mean, if I hadn't done well in that battle and we hadn't won it, you wouldn't be here sitting here now, would you? Talking to me, asking me to talk, you know, for the BBC. So it must have done... You wouldn't have come before the war as a straight 21-year-old flying instructor. You wouldn't have wanted my opinion about anything then.
The other thing is that, what do you think it says to, say, young people now? What its importance to them is that they would have lived a different sort of life. You just sort of said that, more or less. If you've got something that you would like to say about that battle to people today, I mean, is it just a gone, forgotten, past thing, or does it really have something to say to people today?
No. I don't moralise. I can't see any moral in it. I think we were very, very lucky to be able to win the battle. As I say, it was essential that we did win it. And I'm really quite pleased that people still seem to remember it as being an absolute milestone in the history of the British Empire, if empire is not a dirty word.
But it was worth it to be alive at that time, was it?
Yes, I think it was one of the reasons why there's all this breakdown in discipline and law and order, and what it is that the present generation hasn't had a war to fight.
That struck me, obviously, in preparing this thing, in talking to people about it. But, I mean, do we really have to go through a war to give ourselves some direction, some discipline?
Is it that direction and discipline that we're talking about, or is it that they've just got no opportunity to blow off steam the way we had? I mean, I didn't have to write anything on a lavatory wall. I went out there and shot down a German aircraft. Got anything that I had in my system right out of it.
That's also crossed my mind. That I mean, would it be really unkind to think that you had a lovely machine given you? You could go around faster than most other things moving at that time. And the price of it was that you had to fight a few battles.
Yes, and that was what you were wanting to do anyway, wasn't it? The excitement, I think, for these hooligans and things like that is the fact that they break up a telephone box and then they're fighting the police, aren't they? I'm not trying to compare myself with them.
All right.